On America Can We Talk, I talk about election integrity, border security, healthcare freedom, race relations, energy and tax policy, education policy, free speech and assembly, freedom of religion, and all other issues that touch on the God-given right of every American to life, liberty, and the pursuit of their version of happiness. Stay tuned. You preach your tolerance, but lecture me. Is there no end to your own hypocrisy? Your God is power, you have no shame. Your only interest is political gain. You hide your eyes and refuse to listen. You play your game.
Coming up next, America Can We Talk with your host, Debbie Georgiatos.
And hello and welcome to America Can We Talk. I'm Debbie Georgiatos, and thank you so much for tuning in our Thursday afternoon shows. My favorite day of the week. It used to be Saturday, but now it's Thursday because how great it is to have this Thursday show every week. We have a great guest joining us in studio. I'll introduce her in just a moment. I want to say a few quick thank yous. The music everyone loves, my intro music, is actually sung by Krista Branch. And it is I'm America. I urge you to look up the lines, look them up. And I mean, every word of that song is exactly what this show is. The idea that the people who will shape America's future are the ones who step up, get involved. And so Krista Branch has this music, I'm America. She sings. Her husband wrote both the music and the lyrics. And I always want to say thank you to them. I told them I'd say thank you to them for allowing us to use this music. Also want to thank Real News PR, my wonderful producer, Emilio Diaz, and Real Communications Network. This show rocks and rolls because they are just so incredibly helpful. I'm grateful for all of them. So we're going to talk today with someone who is just an extraordinarily brave person. She's here visiting Texas from the state of Minnesota, and she is the author of this book, which we're going to talk about. It is called They're Lying. I'll show you in a moment. They're Lying, The Media, the Left, and the Death of George Floyd. And it is a fabulous book. She also is the producer and moderator of a film that is called The Fall of Minneapolis. You can actually watch it online. I watched it again this morning online as I was preparing for the show today. A really, really great book and documentary. And it's all focused on the death of George Floyd. And I will just say, when you finish listening to everything we're talking about, hear the story that didn't get told, I think your view of the whole George Floyd incident will be changed entirely. And this is, like many other issues in this time, the people who speak up to go against a popular narrative, who go against what the media and the left try to say is the truth, and they just simply dig in and speak truth, these are brave people. And that's who we have, one of many brave Americans joining us today, Liz Collin. Help me welcome her to the show. So,
thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I certainly love Texas. This is the place to be.
Hey, this is great. So I'll tell you folks, Liz and her husband Bob are visiting us. So just because you want them to feel at home in Texas, we went to Buc-ee's this morning. Just
yes.
Saying, yeah, we all know, everyone knows Buc-ee's, okay.
Which is reason enough to move here, yes.
Yes, it is. So, I didn't say a whole lot about your background, except you're here from Minnesota. You've been, I'll tell the one little story about your childhood, and then you can tell us about your adult life. So, when she was a child, she decided, very young, she wanted to be a newspaper reporter. And so she started a newspaper in her hometown called Neighborhood News. And she just wrote news, 10 years old, wrote news about the neighborhood. Well, a local channel picked up on this. They commented periodically, then they picked up on it, WCCO, and they invited her in to be on the show and say, well, you want to be a news reporter? Tell us all about that. So she's telling her story. And the final question the person interviewing her asked was, what do you want to do when you grow up? And she answered, I want your job. And she actually got his job a few years later. So I love that story. I love that idea of wanting to be a reporter. So if you would, take us off before we dive into your book, your career background, after your 11-year-old conversation in WCCO.
A few years have passed since then, yes. I grew up really being obsessed with the news from the time I was young. I grew up in Worthington, Minnesota. It's kind of located in the southwest corner of the state. And I moved away, graduated high school. I started in Sioux Falls as a news anchor at 19. I basically got my associate's degree and started anchoring when I was 19. I moved to Wichita, Kansas. I would go to college in the afternoons to get my four-year degree, and I would anchor the morning show in the mornings. Got my four-year degree, and then I was off to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I lived out there for a couple years as a reporter, and I kind of landed, you know, what was kind of considered my dream job. I was always working to go back home to the Minneapolis area. So I actually got a job at the station I grew up watching and sort of landed that dream job, and that was back in 2008.
I love that. I mean, a lot of people are still looking for their career path when they're in their mid-40s. So it's a really, really great thing to have and then pursued it and done it. So you're in Minneapolis, and this WCCO, your regular anchor, and I should have mentioned introducing you, Emmy Award-winning. I mean, this is a real serious career journalist-type news reporter. So, in fact, do you like news reporter, journalist? What are your...
You know, I've been called a lot worse, so whatever you want to say. I know that word gets thrown around a little bit now with journalism and such. But yeah, I was a familiar face in Minneapolis. I worked there for nearly 15 years at the station, but I was the highest rated weekend anchor, a position I held for years. I won many Emmy Awards. My reporting helped to change many laws in Minnesota. I really considered myself, you know, a part of the community. I cared about what was happening in that state. And that's kind of what was happening in my professional life, which kind of collided with my personal life on May 25th of 2020, being married to a Minneapolis police officer.
Yes, and so I should have mentioned you're married to a former police officer, and then he actually was part of the and head of the police union. So he had a long career, very successful career as a police officer, moved up the ranks and eventually became the head of the police union. So very well respected, very connected to the policing community. So May 25th, 2020 came along, and the George Floyd incident happened in Minneapolis. So just as one start, what is the reason you began to be suspicious about the narrative the media was reporting?
Oh gosh, you know, it really started right away. And even with how the media had changed over the years, I saw that really before my eyes. Not so much what we were telling the public, it seemed on so many stories, but what we just decided not to anymore. And I was sort of, you know, bothered by this on an ethical and moral level, but it seemed that so many people were just willing to go along with it, again, on so many subjects. But I'd never seen it in such a grand scale kind of happening right in front of me than with this incident. So right away, we have, for the very first time in Minneapolis police history, they withhold the body camera footage for this critical incident. Obviously, we're all allowed to see the viral Facebook video, but as in any police interaction, there's always more to every issue, but they usually always had been transparent. What's the point of having all of these officers, you know, be equipped with body cameras if you're not gonna actually show the public when there is an incident that video? So they quickly hid that video. Also, I've talked about the very next day, you have the police chief and the mayor. They come out early on and say that they have no idea what's going on there at 38th and Chicago. This is not a part of police training, what these officers are doing, specifically Derek Chauvin. And I went to the police training manual, and you can easily see that these two pages are just mysteriously gone from that document, which had been there for years.
I will get back to that, because that was one of the most stunning things. I will tell you that I was one of the people who saw the Facebook video. This was a bystander, took the little video that half of America or more saw, and it looked clearly like this one officer had, and because you saw nothing leading up to it, seemed to be violent unnecessarily and was pinning George Floyd's neck to the pavement, and the angle and the commentary made it look like this was a, however long it was, 9 minutes of actual just unprovoked, unprompted, unnecessary suppression of him. I mean, real dangerous treatment toward him. And people saw that, they saw nothing else for the longest time. And so others and myself included, formed the impression, wow, this officer was out of control. But back to your first reaction, I was gonna tell you, I think it's in your book, I've forgotten the timing, but very shortly after the incident, four officers involved, very quickly, the Minneapolis police announced that the officers are going to be terminated. And that was before an investigation, correct?
That's correct. And also, just within a few hours of the incident, the police chief makes a call to the FBI. So the FBI is involved within just a few hours. That's something Bob had never seen before. And this all comes to light. I'm sort of keeping kind of copious notes on the story, because I was kicked off the anchor desk. I was never allowed to anchor the news ever again. God forbid you're married to a police officer during this incident. As crazy as this sounds, this was really the reality of the time. But you could just quickly see how much information they were hiding and how they were manipulating this on so many levels, unlike anything, you know, that I'd ever seen before.
And this police chief, I may not be saying his name correctly, Arredondo, had your husband had worked under him and respected him, correct?
They had a fine relationship for years. Yeah, they worked very similar times, and it was almost as if that just changed overnight.
Okay, so the George Floyd incident, I want to get to the officer video. In fact, I did send it, Emilio, if you do have it, okay. I sent a short clip from this film, and I'm going to just say something about that now, and we're going to resume this in a moment, but in the film, The Fall of Minneapolis, much of the police officer video is played out, is laid out in this film. And what it does for people who didn't really know what happened, it changes your entire perspective. It changes what you think happened and what led up to what seemed to be very rough behavior. And then I will tell you, I debated this morning back and forth about playing this segment because it's painful to watch and it's a little bit, when you're first watching it, you're thinking, this guy, he's kind of sympathetic. He's drugged out of his mind. He's not cogent. He's emotional. He's going through a kind of a irrational begging, sobbing, at the same time kicking officers, just irrational behavior. And you can first see it and thought, my gosh, the guy's just a mess. But what this is all of this background video, which you'll see just a bit of it in a moment, led up to the interaction that all of us saw, that tiny little face. Someone took a video on their camera and put up on Facebook. So let's see if we can play that one little segment, if you could please, Emilio. And put it up here too, if you can, please.
That people do stuff. And y'all don't know me.
Take a seat.
Okay.
Why are you having trouble walking?
Because my hands are hurt.
Down,
we will
okay?
Please, man. Please don't do
this. Take a seat.
I'm going in.
No, you're not.
I gotta go in.
Take a seat.
Grab a seat, man.
Mind, y'all don't believe me.
Take a seat.
I'm not the kind of guy. I'm not the kind of guy, man.
Take a seat.
No, I'm a dieter.
Take a seat.
I'm a die, man.
You need to take a seat right now.
And I just had COVID, man. I don't want to go back to that.
Can you cut off for a second? Okay. You know, I should have said part of what occurred that people did not see. First of all, the attempted arrest originally was for using counterfeit money. And when the police approached him, he was in a car already, in his own vehicle, and was going to be driving away. And the police, first two officers, tried to stop him and tried to say, put your hands on the wheel, the things officers say all the time, to make sure you're not lunging for a weapon or something. And I couldn't play the whole long segment, but what I tuned into there, I meant to introduce this, these are the officers who've had to physically struggle to get him out of the car, could not restrain him because he was, he's a large man and he was very, very aggravated. And they tried to calm him down and he's alternating between sobbing emotion and an accusatory and saying things that weren't true. All they're trying to do here, and eventually got to four officers, is to get him to get in the back of the car. He's handcuffed, trying to get him in the back of the car because he's gonna be processed and arrested. Let's go ahead and play the rest and then I'll turn it back to you. He's saying this early on, I can't choke, I can't breathe. He says over and over, way before he's on the ground, way before some officer is trying to restrain him.
Before Derek Chauvin is even on the scene.
Yes. But this is the original two officers who arrive in the scene. Derek Chauvin's not even there yet, and he's yelling out, I can't breathe. Go ahead, if you'd please.
I'm going down. I'm going down. Get in the squad. I'm going down. I'm going down. Get in the squad. I'm going down. I'm going down. I'm not going to leave you. You're going to die of a heart attack. I know I can't breathe.
Get in the car.
Okay, so someone's driving by, a bystander tells Mr. Floyd, you're going to die of a heart attack, man. Get in the car. People can see he's resisting. He won't get in the car. Are you? Yeah, a little more? No? Actually, you can stop again. This jumped ahead. I want to set the table for a conversation by pointing out these officers arrived just simply saying, you know, you try to pass counterfeit money, try to arrest him, put him in handcuffs. He's physically fighting. He's, even when he's restrained, he's still fighting and kicking. Four officers, four men, big men, can't even get him in the car. Actually, I'm going to cut it off there. It's excruciating to watch. And it's just and I'm glad you included it. But this is what led up to the final point of saying, well, he won't get in the car. We can't get him in. Four of us can't. So they get him back out. And then that's when they led to this incident that Chauvin was restraining him using this. Right.
Yeah, in all, it's about a 13-minute interaction that the public wasn't allowed to see. And again, the two officers who were on scene that day, Thomas Lane and Alex King, had only been on the job. This is just a couple days in for them off of their field training. So they're brand new officers. They asked George Floyd, what are you on? What did you take? He adamantly denies he took anything at all. You hear George Floyd himself ask to be laid on the ground. And nobody also talks about the fact that Thomas Lane called for an ambulance 36 seconds after he was placed on the ground, and this very problematic EMS response that we get into in the film as well. Really, the point is, why was this information kept from you? And the police chief, the mayor, they all had the opportunity to tell the truth about this from the beginning. Instead, they decided to fan the flames in a very, divisive way. I don't think anybody can deny that and withhold all of this information. If they would have gone frame by frame, as they have for other incidents, and other departments have done this all across the country, to better explain what was happening, perhaps we wouldn't even be here having this conversation today.
Absolutely. And I do want to talk about the behavior of the upper ranks of the police department, as well as the city mayor and the state governor. Everyone seemed to get on board almost instantly with assuming the officers didn't follow procedure, that their behavior caused his death, which, as it turns out, it did not. And to just, as you say, fan the flames, what is driving those people to behave that way?
I think the election year had a lot to do with it. Again, this is May of 2020, and chaos had ensued with COVID. This, race relations is also kind of part of the formula, create chaos. And, I think oust President Trump at any cost. We had the perfect people in Minneapolis for that to play out. I get into quite a few of the politicians and their backgrounds in Minneapolis and in Minnesota. So it was kind of the perfect people for that to happen. You have a socialist city council for the most part in Minneapolis, and activists that were quick to pounce on all of this. But I couldn't really understand. I say, Minnesota nice, everybody knows that, but it was Minnesota naive. The fact that we were this naive for this to just be allowed to happen. But so much information withheld, I know we'll probably get into the autopsy a little bit, and then, we have buildings start to burn and people start to die, basically all around the world related to this.
Absolutely. I do want to turn on the autopsy now, because I didn't know until I read your book, I believe I have it happily marked here, but the original, so George Floyd passes on May 25th, 2020. The original, the actual autopsy examination of the body is done by Hennepin County Medical Director, I think his title was Dr. Baker. Mm-hmm. And just go ahead and tell what Baker found.
So within 12 hours of George Floyd passing away, Dr. Andrew Baker conducts the only, to this day, official autopsy done on George Floyd. In that autopsy, it shows there's no asphyxiation, no strangulation marks, no bruising on the neck. Three times the lethal limit of fentanyl is found in George Floyd's system. Methamphetamine, he has a bad heart with 97% blockage in one artery alone. He has a paraganglioma, which is a tumor that can lead to sudden death. Many things that are very apparent right away. They do have to wait a little bit for those toxicology results. However, instead of getting this information out there, you have these backdoor meetings that then take place. And Dr. Baker is talking to prosecutors, and also the FBI is present at these meetings as well. And instead of releasing this official autopsy, it's about a week later, after 1,500 businesses were either damaged or destroyed by rioting, several people died, they then decide to release this official autopsy on the same day George Floyd's family releases their autopsy, that they call an independent autopsy. And the media goes ahead and touts that as an independent autopsy.
But that second autopsy put together by George Floyd's family, this was not an examination of the body.
No, they basically say that George Floyd died from what you see in the video. That's
all they would have to look at is to produce an alleged second autopsy is they look at the real autopsy, the actual official one, and then stare at the video. And so it's not an autopsy in any scientific sense of the word. It's just a conclusory statement.
And basically then the Department of Justice conducts a third autopsy that many people don't know about. That basically says exactly what George Floyd's family, their medical examiners say.
So the only autopsy that actually involved examining the body specifically, and why I think it's so important, specifically says he did not die of asphyxiation, because the whole picture from the video seems to be the officer's knee on his neck prevented breathing. And he's yelling, I can't breathe, which is why I thought it was great in your documentary that you put out very early, this footage that shows him yelling, I can't breathe, when no one's stepping on him. They're trying to get him into the backseat of a police car. And he kept saying, I don't want to go. But he's using that language, I think, to cause officers to back off.
Well, and there's also so much to be said about an arrest that took place with George Floyd that happened in 2019. Again, we're told the next day that they've never heard of George Floyd. This is from the police chief at the time. They have no idea who he is. Well, he was the subject of an undercover drug investigation that went on in May of 2019 when they arrest him. And if you play the body camera footage side by side from 2019 and 2020, they are eerily similar, the same reactions. The story isn't how George Floyd died. That's not the documentary, or to disparage George Floyd in any way. But he is a person that had many interactions with police. That's part of his record. But how dare you mention his criminal history or this 2019 arrest? But it all just really played into what took place on that day, and people should have been able to be informed about his entire past.
Absolutely. And so withholding of information by a wide range of people. I mean, it is the FBI got involved very early, this Arredondo, the chief of police. I do want, though, just to make the point in the autopsy, because I think if the fact of the autopsy, the original one, came out right away, as soon as it was completed, and said, turns out the officer's knee and his neck did not cause asphyxiation. It was on the side of his neck. And that the cause of death, according to the first autopsy, was basically massive drug overdose.
Well, and also some other files that have been released just recently related to this case actually have Dr. Baker saying just that. He calls a prosecutor in Hennepin County after he conducts the autopsy, and he says to her, what happens, you know, when the evidence goes against this public narrative? This is the kind of case that ends careers. Those are his words in a deposition. So you could easily see the immense amount of pressure that he was under, and these backdoor meetings, I think, are quite telling, and a lot of that is in the book also, just sort of how the entire narrative was changed over the course of several days.
It's amazing. So the real autopsy, the legitimate one, comes out the same day as the family authorized one, which wasn't
just
real
a few
autopsy.
Hours before. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then you have the DOD one that was you reprinted really easily, so you can see it. But anyway, it was basically a conclusory statement that it seems this was homicide. So that triggers people. That all by itself, mm-hmm. if they don't know what the truth is, and then moving forward from that. So you have this case. You have the officers being fired very early, earlier than mostly the process should have been suspending them while investigations occurring, correct?
Well, in normal circumstances, they would, you know, put them on home assignment. They would still be paid. But no, they fired them immediately with no due process in this case.
Because of public pressure, I think. I mean,
because
isn't
of a viral video.
The viral video and public pressure. So, and you know, it sparked what happened in Minneapolis, obviously sparked all of the riots around this country. I mean, we had massive damage to this country. I'm just getting at it. It's astonishing to me you didn't have more people in positions of authority in Minneapolis saying, wait a minute, before we get too carried away here, this isn't what happened. I mean, what accounts for that?
Well, I'll just say, just from, you know, my personal experience, Bob being the president at the time of the Police Federation, he came out quickly and said, now is not the time to rush to judgment. It was just a statement that was just a few lines. And he had also mentioned George Floyd's criminal history in a basically a memo that was sort of leaked to the media. But even just to say this isn't the time to rush to judgment, there's more to the story. We were going to review the body camera video, which the union was never allowed to see. That's never happened before in any of these cases. Even putting that out immediately put a target on our family. I mean, we had four protests at our house that summer of 2020. Again, I lost my longtime career, essentially, at the station where I worked. I wasn't allowed to report on the air for nearly 2 months. After all of this, and I wasn't really allowed to report on anything of substance ever again, which is why I left, but and why I was able to then put the book out. I don't think where I was working would have liked me putting the book out. But
I don't think so either.
But I couldn't believe that as journalists we were also fine with just pushing this divisive narrative when we were privy to the information very early on, and that's why I called the book "They're Lying," because I kept screaming that at the top of my lungs for months.
Yeah, you were screaming actually at your place of work.
I mean,
trying to say they're lying about everything.
Yeah.
And you are a media person. And I know it's not news to people that there is bias in journalism and a lot of things we have to fight to find the real story. But for you, you're inside and you know these people and they know you, you know them, they know you're honest. And they just weren't going to go there telling the truth.
It just almost seemed as if people didn't care. And again, there was this great fear when you see buildings burn in front of you. It almost just, had that, I think, effect to just shut a lot of people up.
Absolutely. You mentioned the protests at your house, and there was one, I didn't get an image of it, but someone left a note for you. So protests at your home, in fact, they were at the luncheon meeting where you spoke today, you had video of those people. I mean, these are people in your front lawn, not like three protesters carrying signs, but crazy looking people, a lot with masks on, and they had hideous signs they were waving and shouting. And I'm going to get to the one particular guy who was noteworthy, but this is a note left on your door. First of all, the guy can't spell, just saying.
Well, that this came in the mail, yeah.
In the mail, yeah. Resign immediately, or the next mail will be a bomb. We are not effing around, only he says the word. Quit now, or you and Liz are dead, says directed to your husband. No one can protect you, so the choice is yours. Resign now, you effing pig. So this came to your house, and I mean, the idea that your husband, who's doing his job, and he wasn't just a nosy private citizen, he's doing his job, speaking as he was supposed to on behalf of the police union, as well as what you're reporting. And this is the irrationality and lunacy of that summer, and still today, frankly, on the left. Actual threat. So actually, tell the story what happened. You turned this over, and?
Yeah, I mean, I think he ended up with 3 days in jail. for that, they were actually able to find who did it, which is a remarkable story. The fingerprints trace back, which probably won't surprise anyone, to someone who was in a protest in Portland who threw a bottle at a police officer during a protest, and they were able to get fingerprints from that and trace it back to this that came to our address, which I was very excited. I was like, this is CSI.
It is.
I didn't even think that we would turn it in, because we actually received several threats that summer. There were many, many different things. But it was amazing that they were even able to find him. But again, this, even for the peaceful demonstration that took place in front of our house, which was in August of 2020, that was 150 people. You have people swearing at children, making threats. They want to burn down the town where we live, saying this on the bullhorn. I couldn't believe that this was even America and this was allowed to happen.
Well, especially I would say one kind of ringleader of this protest was an actual candidate on the Democrat Party to run for Minnesota State House. And I don't want to steal, you told the story at lunchtime, and it's covered here, but this guy, he's a candidate. He's running for office, and he's yelling into the microphone. Tell us what he was saying first.
He's saying that white supremacists live here, and you have the head of the KKK that lives here, I think is how he was referring to Bob. He's swearing at kids again and again, and he says, he's going to burn the whole city down over this. And I mean, it was just completely appalling. And the DFL, this is the Democratic Party of Minnesota, did not even pull their endorsement from him after all this. And he then beat us in pinata effigy in our driveway. They brought pinatas of us I looked like Hillary Clinton, so that was kind of the thing I was
very thinking. Insulting.
Yeah, that was,
at least I could have made you beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. I was not a very attractive pinata. And the we were dressed as Klansmen in the pinata, so just completely repulsive and disgusting.
Yeah, and you did not really get help from the police in breaking this up, or did they? Did the police come and try to break it up?
We were gone, and so there was a large police presence. They knew about this protest that had been coming. But again, this is also what these, and many of them were paid protesters, let's not forget. Many of them were paid to be there. Many of them openly admitted that summer that they were paid to be there, and they had no idea who we even were. They want that. They want a massive arrest, and they want this attention. And so it was very much a hands off. Let them just, you know, bust the pinata and let them move on. There were enough police there to protect our home and such.
One thing I'll say about you before I launch more into the book and the movie is, you know, these are the kind of things that are happening more and more in America where you didn't really invite the issue. I mean, you didn't obviously invite the George Floyd thing. You didn't. I mean, this is, you were in a position where the conduct of the city in dealing with George Floyd, the conduct of the officers who wouldn't protect the police, you would either watch all of this and stay silent and your husband stay silent, or you speak up and you just have to say, we can't allow this kind of behavior, because obviously what, and I'm going to get to also the trials for these officers, but this is the kind of the slow destruction of the entire rule of law.
Yeah, and I couldn't believe there are so many people, especially who I worked with for years, who knew who I was as a journalist and a person. Nobody said anything. I mean, sure, they were supporting us privately, but they wouldn't publicly. And obviously, we saw great support from the law enforcement community and such. And Bob and I really didn't even know the officers who were involved, but the way that we were thrown into cancel culture, and that's what it is. I mean, it comes at you full force. And we had a young son at the time. He's obviously older now, so that was our real concern because of all these threats and such. And it only takes one whack job to get away with something like this. But this is sort of the reason I went forward with the book, because there are so many people whose lives were destroyed by this. We are actually in a pretty good place. I mean, there's many people who lost their freedom, their careers, and people in other states and even around the world that are still living the consequences to this day. But I just couldn't believe how many people sat silent and they were okay with what was allowed to happen.
Let's turn to the trials now, because the four officers involved, the main one featured in the video, Derek Chauvin, there were so many things that happened in that trial that, I mean, I honestly didn't follow the trial at that time. I just assumed, it looked like a bad video, and of course they're prosecuting him. I want to just run through some of the things that were truly amazing, and just they make it seem more like a public lynching than a trial in America's system of jurisprudence. One being, talk about the method that they use, the maximal restraint.
Yeah, the MRT, the maximal restraint technique. Again, a reference that is clear in the video. They're talking about the MRT on the body camera video. The officers very clearly are discussing this. In Derek Chauvin's trial, the MRT training slide is not even allowed to be introduced as evidence. Judge Peter Cahill said that couldn't be a part of evidence because they could not prove that Derek Chauvin attended the last Minneapolis police training. He must not have signed his name in or something on a document. So he said, nope, that's not going to be a part of this trial, if you can even believe that.
And this term, maximal restraint technique, refers to precisely what he was doing that day after the battle trying to get George Floyd in the back of the car, after the way he, George Floyd, was fighting and in all the conduct that between the officers and him. It was putting him on the ground and using his knee to restrain him on the side of the neck, I think this is, Mike, the most striking point maybe this whole story. That was a trained technique that Officer Chauvin and others learned, but yet in the trial, the judge would not allow evidence of that in.
So the jury never saw anything when it came to MRT. In fact, you have the chief and the head of training during that trial say that this isn't something they recognize as part of training. So they're on the stand, and which I think is quite telling in and of itself. But yeah, and Thomas Lane is the one that says let's just MRT. He says that during the actually on the body camera.
So on that subject, it was the chief of police who testified, didn't know anything about that, that wasn't correct, and also a woman who was the head of training, correct? both of them. So, I mean, this is what it makes it more and more. It's like a conspiracy. I'm not saying they obviously didn't cook it up ahead of time, but they all agreed we're not going to do anything to help these officers, to help the jury understand the truth.
Yeah, and I think that comes out in the documentary as well. You know, we interviewed more than a dozen police officers for the fall of Minneapolis, and I asked that question to all of them. You know, were you trained in MRT, the maximal restraint technique? Every officer says yes. In fact, we actually interviewed the man who wrote the policy as part of the documentary. And the officers talk about that, you know, it all obviously all has to be edited down to make, we wanted to kind of stick to a 90-minute documentary, but just the kind of message that sent during that trial, it was kind of in many ways, the last straw for many officers, that this is how deep this goes.
It had to be, because if you don't think your own department is going to tell the truth you maybe think they won't defend you if you did something that was questionable, but a technique they've trained, you know they've trained it, they know they've trained it, you have to use it in the most extreme circumstance, and they just lie. I mean, the chief of police and the training person, and the other thing was really a note I remember from your film very well, was the mother of one of these officers in an interview with you saying she brought up the actual physical manual her son had taken home from his training that had this exact technique.
Maximal restraint technique. Yeah, we found manuals from the early 90s that had references to MRT, which the policy has almost stayed, you know, the same for all of these years. That's Derek Chauvin's mom, who's in the documentary, and she uses a few choice words, but said she just wanted to stand up in court and scream and calling them liars and such.
Yeah, you talk about loss of trust in the system, loss of trust in your fellow officers, and you mentioned how once people observed how the police were didn't back up their officers, went for termination very early, lied about this training technique. So I would think you'd lose morale in the police department. It got to be.
Oh, certainly all of this sent a message. I mean, even really from the very beginning, and I talk a lot about this in the book and documentary too, with the riots, how they serve up these officers to surrender the third precinct, another one of those peaceful protests that took place. But that was a planned surrender of this police station. And these officers, the night they're finally going to give up, the thought was they were going to give up the third precinct in order to get the rioting to stop. They thought that would work, as crazy as that sounds. But the officers then give up the building, and they basically have to run to this city bus that's parked a half a mile away. That bus is actually late to even pick them up as they're being pelted with rocks and bottles. All of their squads are smashed out. Some are driving. They have to actually ram the fence to even get outside because they've been basically barricaded in by these rioters.
Yeah, there's a woman who is written about in the book, and you also interviewed her in the film, and she may have been in charge of the third precinct that evening, or she was a senior officer in some way. And I mean, just the idea, she was good in conveying, I could never have imagined that in America you would have a major police department surrender a precinct, meaning you let the rioters take over a police department, a building that is where the police are housed, and they let the rioters take it over. It was like the police didn't feel they could push back against the rioters at all.
They were not given permission to do so. They have a command to follow. Bob always talks about, you know, there's been riots in Minneapolis before. This wasn't the first time this has ever happened. But before, they were allowed to do things, to, you know, use tear gas, to wear their body armor. They couldn't even do that with these riots because they thought it sent a message that, you know, they looked too militaristic. So you can even hear, I mean, for the documentary, I listened to probably 30 or 40 hours of audio of officers again and again saying, can we do this? No. Can we use this? No. Can we, it's unbelievable how many times they were told they can't do anything. So at a certain point, again, so many officers, as you hear in the documentary, that was, you know, their final days. They knew that they had to leave, the Minneapolis Police Department.
You were saying a number earlier at the time of, roughly around the time of this incident, there were about 900 officers?
Yeah, the beginning, I think it's 890 at the total number of officers in Minneapolis. The start of May of 2020, and that number is barely 500 at this point, and actually getting worse almost every week.
You know, and it changes not just, I mean, I know if I were even a child thinking of becoming an officer, you can't trust the people above them to tell the truth. You can't trust the superiors. You can't, your whole engagement plan or kind of design had to be very different once this all happened and the officers get prosecuted, they get convicted, they're all in prison. You're thinking as an officer, the department won't back me up. The community is not wanting, is you know, all on edge. I mean, I just keep thinking, what are these people in charge of the police department, what do they think is going to happen? I mean, what's going to happen to Minneapolis?
Well, we speak to an officer who still is currently on the job. I think who got in a little bit of trouble for being in the documentary. So I commend him for that. But he just says, you know, it isn't enough, and he doesn't know what the end is. And what's so infuriating is if you watch the local news in Minneapolis, they're fine to put the mayor of Minneapolis on television to talk about how crime is down and how safe it is, and come downtown, and it's really like living in just like on Mars or something, you know, and that's what this officer talks about, just how irresponsible the messaging is when that's clearly not the case. Hennepin County has picked up, their sheriff's department has picked up some of the work, but more than anything, policing has changed dramatically in Minneapolis after this. Policies, I think, still to this day are being rewritten. Interestingly enough, MRT was still a part of police policy up until just March of last year. It just recently went away, the maximal restraint technique. But you have to call a supervisor if you handcuff someone. That's a use of force.
You have to call a supervisor.
You have to call a supervisor if somebody is handcuffed in an arrest. You can't chase. They have a no chase policy. So really, it's a place where these opportunists have clearly taken over. It's really lawlessness almost on a daily basis.
The inmates running the asylum. You know what else? One reason I play, and I will tell you again, audience and you, I really debated playing even that little bit of video, because if you watch the longer version, you can see what happens. The officer's trying to arrest him. It is a perpetual disruption and fighting and no cohesion, no coherent answer, and couldn't acknowledge he was actually under the influence of drugs, which he was. If you listen to him 30 seconds, you can tell he's under the influence of drugs. I mean, the guy was just, you know, really, really falling apart. And I have people, I've imagined the thought, people saying, well, you know, once they saw George Floyd wasn't going to allow them to arrest him, why don't they just let him go? I mean, why end up restraining him? What's your answer to that?
Yeah, and I think, that's something we've obviously heard. You know, this is just a $20 bill. Why does it matter? The officers could clearly tell something was wrong with this guy. So are they supposed to just let him drive away, and then he kills somebody in a traffic accident? And then how does that, they knew that something was going on with this guy. And you know, there were many things recovered in his vehicle, which is a whole other story, drugs and counterfeit bills and such. But Derek, we've had many conversations with Derek, said, of course, we had to take him into custody. You can't just release him, write him a ticket there. Something was obviously wrong with him.
Yeah, I was struck more than anything else this whole, watching this, the film originally and watching again this morning, and even this, how you really try to put yourself in an officer's place. And you are, you know, this is a neighborhood, I'm going to guess, a fair amount of challenge with crime. You know, they were called because someone had he robbed this, well, when you pass a counterfeit bill, you know, you're essentially robbing the store, and the store owner, the shop clerk, had said, you know, something's wrong with him. He's really drunk or something. Mm-hmm. And so when you're the officer, I urge people who just keep cringing at the thought of what happened with George Floyd that day to think, what was the other choice the officers had? I want people to think about that, because if you have some sympathy for George Floyd, he was a mess. He was a sympathetic figure. He was drugged out. But what is an officer whose job it is to keep the community safe? What else could they do but arrest him?
So you have, again, this ambulance call within 36 seconds, and they're recognizing what's taking so long, because medical response is usually just a couple minutes away from how close the fire station is. And you then have Tu Tao, another officer on the scene who's sort of in charge of crowd control as part of this, because, you know, people are shouting things at the officers and such. And this is the very first time that Alex King notices Derek Chauvin even unclips his mace. Chauvin had actually trained Alex King And so Alex could tell that Derek was getting a little worried about the crowd as well. And then Tutau calls for an ambulance again because he's going, why are they, you know, what's taking so long? And actually, these officers are almost kind of downgrading, if you will, their response to George Floyd. They can recognize something's wrong. They're feeling for a pulse and such. And Thomas Lane speaks to this, that they thought he was just passing out, which is not uncommon for someone who has taken a large amount of drugs. And they couldn't figure out where the ambulance was. And he was pronounced dead at the hospital sometime later. So again, there's just, the point is there is so much more to this entire interaction, entire story.
Well, there is, and I know we don't want to have the, because I just noticed the time, but, and I want to be sure we can talk about the larger impact. And we do have a time for people in the audience to ask questions. Yes. But, you know, this, to dive into this story and the depth you did, is the only way to help people rethink what the consequence, what happened because of this. Because the story, the truth wasn't told, the camera, the video camera wasn't released in a timely manner. The people in the jury did not realize that this hold was permitted. It really spawned an entire massive national summer and you know, more than into a year, really, of riots, destruction, and death, and all because these people wouldn't speak up and tell the truth in the beginning and tell the people this guy did not die because of that hold on him.
Yeah, and we, you know, there's a reason we wanted to call the documentary The Fall of Minneapolis. Just as I worked with a great editor for the book and director, Dr. J.C. Shea is his name. He's a former police officer as well. So to work with him, he did great amounts of research. They're all on thefallofminneapolis.com. We're not a couple of conspiracy theorists. This is all public documentation. So I encourage people to look at everything involved with the case for themselves, because it really does stand out. But the reason we went ahead with, you know, the fall of Minneapolis is because it really did lead to the fall of this really amazing city. I mean, I was proud to be from Minnesota before all of this. I had a house in Minneapolis before all of this. And crimes that just never occurred in Minneapolis happen on a nearly daily basis now.
Yeah, it really has. And I mentioned to you previously when we first connected that, you know, my dad grew up in Minnetonka. We spent our summers growing up in Minnesota. We have dozens and dozens of cousins up there. My mom is from the area too. So, I mean, Minnesota, I always picture it as just kind of this really happy place and great families. So, and it is mostly a safe and secure environment, except in the big cities. And in Minneapolis, I feel for the people, because that's how I thought about it too. We used to, I don't have family stories, but we spent summers there and I love that city. And I get around to how are we going to get it back? I mean, what has to happen to get the whole police arrangement back on track, to get the people feeling safe again? You're saying crime is up. Like what can Minneapolis do?
Well, I think that supporting law enforcement is huge. And I blame the media as much as anybody else for all of this too, because again, it's their jobs to care about the truth. I mean, there's a whole heck of a lot of reporters in Minneapolis. To this day, not one single legacy media station has ever asked me to do an interview, or the Star Tribune, the largest newspaper in Minnesota. They've ignored all of this as well, because it doesn't fit the agenda. And it's really just, it's sad. I feel like the profession lost me. I didn't feel like, you know, I walked away from the profession, if that makes sense. And it's just kind of very troubling to me what this has all become, that they're fine pushing this propaganda. But I think people need to support law enforcement. They need to vote more than anything else. And get involved. A lot of people, again, just decide not to, which is also a choice. Doing nothing is also a choice.
Yeah, on that subject, and we were talking earlier about this, I do think of more people in Minnesota. There's just the kind of salt of the earth, law-abiding people. They want to work hard, take care of the kids, all that kind of stuff. They need to take charge. They need to decide, we're going to get more people to vote. We're going to vote out Keith Ellison, that'd be good. But I mean, vote out many people who are just not on the side of law and order, not on the side of America. I do want to ask you briefly to speak about him. He got in the middle of all this very early, your attorney general there.
Well, this is part of his history. This is all, and this was amazing to me also, that the press is well aware of Keith Ellison, who is a longtime gang attorney. That was his job, and he had a long time hatred of Minneapolis police. That was no secret. In fact, he represented someone associated with the assassination of a Minneapolis police officer decades ago, which not only did he, was he the prosecutor involved with all four of these officers, he also was responsible for putting Kim Potter behind bars, which is a case involving Dante Wright that happened right around this, all this same time. So again, this was sort of what he ran on in a way. He had a very anti-law enforcement sentiment.
Yeah, and that's what's the most amazing thing, because I think because of George Floyd, many people look at Minnesota and say, wow, something's way out of whack there. But I do truly believe that the majority of Minnesotans, they're Minnesota nice. I mean, they are really, really good people, and they don't want this, and they can't figure out how to get a hold of it. So I, my mind always goes to, you know, not community organizing, that's a left term, but organize the voter base, get them out, get them activated, because I don't want to surrender Minnesota, but it does seem like it's kind of completely out of control.
I say we all can't move to Florida. Maybe we can all move to Texas, though. You guys,
there's a lot of land here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, one last thing, we'll turn to questions right now for the audience if you have, but I want to mention one more thing. You did a really good thing toward the end. I'll find where this is in here. You talked about a young girl who was a Turning Point USA spokesman or something in her high school, and included her story. Her name is Avery Severinson. Included her story, and you know, it's really part of this message of this whole incident is when narratives get going and they are, everyone thinks it, and no one is willing to say, wait a minute, let's look at the facts. Why do we think this is true? You end up with, you end up with the whole George Floyd, you know, a choir boy, you know, innocent man assaulted versus what really happened. And then all the anger that ensued and all the racial division and hatred spread around the country. Well, in her case, this is kind of cool you included her. You can tell her story. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. She's accused. She's a White Bear Lake High School student at the time, president of this Turning Point USA chapter there. And she's accused of sending a racist text message. Because, of course, it's this conservative girl. It has to be her. And the FBI comes in. They find out within just a couple of days that it was actually this African-American girl who sent the text message herself. And so at this point, the news had covered it. There was all these walkouts. You know, there's this racist conservative at this school. Well, nobody goes back to even correct the record at all. Wherever, you know, there was a press release put out, the media completely ignores that. Still to this day, you know, again, I talk about these stations in Minneapolis, but they just a few weeks ago celebrated George Floyd's 50th birthday. That was the lead story on the news. So it's really hard to, you know, it's hard when you have to counter
absolutely. Before we turn to questions, I want to urge people, this book, first of all, we have some for sale after the show today. You can buy them right in this room. We were at a luncheon today where they sold a whole ton of them. And one point people were making, and I want to repeat it, which is, you know, if you are a young person in this country and you've been shaped by kind of propaganda education, you've been shaped by the left, and you hear this George Floyd story, it kind of fits the narrative that the left has been trying to say about America. You know, it's a deeply racist country, and we have, you know, 1619 Project tells you to hate America. This story, what really happened and what really prompted all the riots, needs to be shared with young people, with people in, I don't mean just, you know, I mean junior high school age, but I mean people, you know, up your children, your grandchildren. People should understand what happened, not just because of this story, but help. It prompts you to recognize you have to question a narrative. You have to question a story that's stirring people up. So you ought to order 10 or more copies, and it's called They're Lying, the Media, the Left, and the Death of George Floyd by Liz Cullen, with whom we've been speaking. Order these, share it with people. You don't even have to have a conversation. Just say, read this, and then we'll talk. Or share her incredibly wonderful documentary she produced, The Fall of Minneapolis. We found it just amazingly engaging, and you can watch it online at no charge.
No charge. It's free.
No charge. Okay. So I don't know if you have questions in the audience. Say, there we go.
Yes. Hi.
Hello.
Okay. It's great to see you again. I have a million questions for you, but let me try to limit just a couple. One, can you give me the timeline between his death and when the riots started? And I just see that there were 19 deaths in the following 2 weeks with riots?
In Minneapolis specifically, there were four. But the riots really started, I would say, 48 hours that things started burning. There were certainly the next day, you know, gatherings and whatnot, but we really saw the fires and such sort of that second day.
Okay. And then the next, as Debbie mentions, vote these people out of office. Can you comment on Minneapolis or Minnesota has a 6-week voting, early voting period and same day registration and
exactly.
a long history of voting irregularities with Al Franklin.
It's an uphill battle there for sure. And actually, interestingly, I put this book out in October of 2022 before the election, thinking, all right, this is my part, because, you know, a lot of these people were reelected in the wake of all of this. But, you know, the book was obviously completely ignored by the media. So I expected that. But Mayor Fry was reelected. Governor Walz was reelected. Keith Ellison, the attorney general, was reelected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I forgot about that. Governor Walz, didn't even mention him. He was another just kind of firebomb thrower, just continue agitating mm-hmm. people. Never tried to bring peace to the situation, never tried to help people understand the truth. He just let the thing keep.
And he also told students that they needed to pause for 9 minutes for George Floyd each year. That was a governor's directive as part of this, yeah.
Okay, I'm about to get the hook. So I was going to throw in a conspiracy question, which you had heard someone speaking about. Really, it was like a land play. They wanted to kind of get rid of mm-hmm. this neighborhood. And when you hear that and you hear Hawaii, but then can you talk about the police chief is now what, he's HUD or something? What, he went from there to?
Yeah, he
and
is.
And then I thought, maybe there is something
yeah,
there.
Yeah, he currently. Everybody got a promotion. We'll just say that. Everybody who lied got a promotion. I think that's probably a good way to answer it. Yeah.
Hello.
That's amazing.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
I have seen the documentary. I haven't read the book, but I'm going to get that. Very good documentary. Very much eye-opening. My question really, number one, how's the book do, since it's not getting any promoting, how's it doing? Because I find that a lot of things that the mainstream media won't push, there's still a huge like thirst for it. So hopefully that's the case with your book.
Yeah, actually it was an Amazon bestseller for a couple months after putting it out, which is sort of what led us to the documentary. I thought, okay, people don't think I'm Yay. Completely crazy. They thought that something else perhaps was going on. And that just means, you know, you rank in the top categories so you can find a book easier. Amazon mysteriously took down the book. It took me about a month to get it back up. That was over this last summer. So And then putting out the documentary again, there's been more interest with the book and whatnot. But there are rules that, you know, Barnes & Noble won't sell it in their store. They'll sell it online. There's just a lot of different things, you know. We self-published the book, so we don't have a big publisher to kind of fight our battles for us. We just kind of do it ourselves. But there's definitely censorship and whatnot that you have to fight.
Right. I'm glad it's doing well. Secondly, Derek Chauvin. What now that all of this stuff has come out, what's happened to him?
Well, and thank you for the question. It was 9 days after putting out the documentary that he was stabbed 22 times in prison. By a former FBI informant. Just horrific, horrific news. He's in the medical unit, still recovering. He had some nerve damage, so doesn't walk like he used to. His family has been able to see him. They've been out there. They still don't know if he'll stay there or if he'll move. He has a couple appeals in the wake of this and, you know, this new legal team. And we update the case quite a bit on Alpha News. The other officers pled guilty, so they will serve a couple more years yet, each of them, and be lifelong felons after all of this.
And actually, one I meant to mention, one was on his third shift as an officer, and the other, another one had been the fourth day on the job, something I mean, these people were brand new, and I mean, there were more senior officers involved, but imagine all the police training, go to the academy, getting all you have to do to accomplish that, mm-hmm. and this, you know, and they were, this happens, it's so unjust. Excuse me, go ahead.
Hi, I met you at the viewing before. I think what I keep seeing is, as life goes on, is a continual realization that there's onlooking just everywhere. In Maui, there's a story there. The border, the trafficking, Uvalde, your situation there. I was wondering, as you see all these things, how certain does that create reinforcement to you that this is definitely something that is more than just a bad day, that there's an upper echelon that definitely suppress the truth. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that we have to keep reminding ourselves that we have an enemy. This is not just an event. Right. And I was just curious what your thoughts were about
that. No, it's a good question, because I've said that I was really always a middle of the road reporter, not a political person. I always kind of believed in, you know, being balanced and whatnot. But this is truly a fight against evil, is how I look at this more than anything else, and how it really can take just a few people to go along with it for this to happen. I mean, this is amazing to me that only just it only took a few people for everybody to go ahead and believe all this. But certainly I was, there were so many parts of this case that really my hair would almost stand up, you know, on my arms, around my neck. I just felt like, oh my gosh, this is the kind of manipulation that people are up against. And it's really frightening. I mean, even taking a look at what happened to Derek after putting out the documentary. No incidents at all in that prison for 15 months, and he's killed. I mean, the guy was trying to kill him. He was nearly, you know, a nearly fatal attack, but he was able to fight him off. But he was trying to murder him in prison.
Oh, gosh. Mm-hmm. Maybe, actually, we're kind of out of time. You know, I think we can stay after. There are books to be purchased, but we kind of are out of our official time. And I want to just, first of all, thank you for coming here today. This could be a 3-hour interview. Honestly, I hope we skim the surface. I hope we hit the things you wanted to hit.
No, I'm always happy to come back to Texas too, Debbie, so thank you.
All right, okay, that's good. And I urge people to buy They're Lying by Liz Collin. Order this book, send it to your 25 best friends, wake people up. Also, check out The Fall of Minneapolis. The website is just thefallofminneapolis.com. Watch the film there. It's a great film to watch. It's a little painful to watch because you're dealing with reality, but it's extraordinary. I urge you to watch that. And Liz Collin, thank you so very much for coming here today.
Thank you, Debbie, so much for having me.
So fun to have you. For our shows upcoming, a week from today, we're actually going to air a show next Thursday that I pre-recorded yesterday. And the reason I did it is because I got someone to come to Texas. He's actually a London citizen, but his name is Jason Cousins. And he, along with Mike Carter, who works at Liberty Hawk Ranch, and also Texas State Senator Mark DeRazio, and the three of them and myself for an hour talked about the amazing opportunity that we in America could have to fight against central bank digital currency, fight against more government control over our economic system by getting into a system. This Jason Cousins is the founder of Glint, which is a private company. You buy gold through it, and you get a debit card, and you're basically shopping for using your money wherever you spend money. It goes against your gold. It's easy to do. There's also a big push in Texas and 25 other states to try to have the states create. We have in Texas a bullion depository, and I know this sounds like a pitch, or I am not being paid for this, and I'm not going to make any money off of this. It's a freedom issue. It's a freedom issue if we can encourage people, encourage legislators to pass the laws, and encourage citizens to use this idea of using gold as basically digital currency. So that's next week, but was pre-recorded, so you don't come here next week. And then the following week, we have Professor David Clements, former New Mexico law professor, has a film out now called Let My People Go. Let My People Go is about election fraud. It's very good. I've watched it. He's going to be in person here. And the following week after that, we have Dr. Eitan Haim, a Texas doctor who became a whistleblower at the Children's Hospital, where after Texas passed a law saying we do not engage in gender mutilation of children, we don't do that, not drug treatments, not surgery, the hospital was continuing to do that and lying about it. So he became a whistleblower. He's going to tell that story. And then after he became a whistleblower, the FBI knocked on his front door. And what happened after that is simply astounding. So that's the next few weeks' shows. We are past out of time, so I want to thank you so very much for tuning in to America Can We Talk. You can find every past show we've ever done at AmericaCanWeTalk.org. Check out our blogs, our past shows, past interviews, and thank you for tuning in every week to America Can We Talk. I do this show to speak truth about America because America matters, and I will talk to you next time.
Can We Talk? Truth about America.
Can you hear?